Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for June 5th. I'm your volunteer reader, Jack Palmer. In this hour, we'll be reading headlines, Valiant State, and USA Today headlines. The first article is titled, Assisted Living Gets New Standards, written by Caitlin McGlade. Assisted living companies will have to raise their standards starting next month after new rules to protect people with dementia cleared their last hurdle with unanimous approval from Arizona regulators. The reforms stem from House Bill 2764, which passed unanimously in the Arizona House of Representatives and was signed by Governor Katie Hobbs in 2024 to create quality standards for dementia care and crack down on facilities that endanger residents. The Arizona Republic published a year-long investigation in 2023 about assisted living residents hurting or killing each other when caregivers didn't know how to handle dementia symptoms, mixed up or forgot medication, or management ignored repeat issues and avoided meaningful penalties. The reporting launched a wave of impact, including the state takeover of a facility that had more violations than anywhere else. The Governor's Regulatory Review Council, charged with vetting new state regulations, met June 3rd to decide whether the Arizona Department of Health Services plan for enforcing the new rule was fair. A firefighter who pleaded with the council to approve the rules shared anecdotes similar to some of what the Republic found in its reporting. Just last week, according to Steve Wagner with the Professional Firefighters of Arizona, crews found a man who had wandered a quarter mile away from his licensed facility. They found him on the ground, injured, scared, and disoriented, and no one from the facility had noted he was missing, he said. Wagner cited another rescue in July in which the bloody footprints of an 84-year-old woman led firefighters to her. That's not care, that's abandonment. These are not isolated incidents, he said. They happen more often than you think, and they haunt us. The State Health Department has negotiated with senior advocates and the assisted living industry since the law was passed last year to deliver the final rules, which they presented to the Governor's Regulatory Review Council on May 28th. The industry pushed back. Some claimed, erroneously, that the proposal's training requirements for dementia care were duplicative. Some complained the cost would hurt businesses and that the state stepped outside its authority by establishing standards for training programs. Some said parts of the law were too vague, such as a section that calls on companies to adequately staff their homes. Former lawmaker Michelle Ugenti-Rita, a Scottsdale Republican, claimed the proposal wasn't vetted. She didn't attend a single stakeholder meeting, however. The resistance seemed to sway a few council members to the position that the State Health Department's plan might need more work. But when it came time for a vote a week later, after reviewing a flurry of information from people supporting the changes, the council approved the reforms. Council members told the industry representatives opposed to the rules that they were made transparently and in line with what the legislature intended. The rules don't seem unduly burdensome, council member John Sunt said. What guides us is not whether or not they're burden-free, but whether they're unduly burdensome, and I have not seen any substantive evidence regarding cost or expense showing it's unreasonable. Vice Chair Frank Thorwald said he was all for the plan, but wished there was more training required than what the law spells out, and routine spot checks to make sure the education sinks in. The rules establish 8 hours of dementia-related training for each caregiver at first and then 4 hours each year afterward. About 25 people addressed the council before their vote at the meeting, which was held virtually. A handful of industry advocates reiterated their opposition. Amy McElroy, president of the Arizona Assisted Living Homes Association, said the state was setting them up for failure. She said heftier fines, which the law calls for when rules to protect residents are broken, may force places to close. There are not already enough beds being provided, McElroy said. This will directly affect the residents and their need of care. People who have loved ones with dementia pushed back. One man pointed out that facilities charge extra when they call their services memory care, while another person said people shouldn't be in the business of providing specialized care to vulnerable people if they don't see the value in training. Many people who spoke supported the measures, including a few who work in the industry. Susan Wilachowski runs 7 assisted living homes in Prescott and Cottonwood. She told the council the changes were very much needed, as homes say they can take people with Alzheimer's and dementia, but boot them out when there is a challenge. Jamie Sloan, who has been a certified caregiver for 20 years, said she was never trained on helping people with Alzheimer's. She told the council she's often the one training people around her because of how long she's worked in the field. Too often, she said, caregivers assume people with dementia know what they're doing and punish them for their behaviors. I'm talking about serious mistreatment, confinement, restraint, taking their food away, calling them names, and physical abuse, she said. Education is one way to ensure these caretakers are providing the necessary levels of care and actually understanding the disease and its individuality. Some people whose loved ones have struggled with bad care addressed the industry lobbyists directly. Kathy McDavid, whose mother, Joanne, was beaten to death by another resident, said her heart broke after she attended the meeting last week when the industry advocates railed against the rule changes. Lobbyists and owners are in no way putting residents first. Instead, they are fighting tooth and nail to minimize owner accountability and maximize profits, she said. This couldn't have been clearer than when they stated how the cost of additional staff training would be borne by residents. I ask you, how is this, as Arizona Leading Age states on their webpage, a commitment to enhance the lives of older adults? Arizona Leading Age is an association for nonprofit long-term care facilities. It wanted the council to do away entirely with the section of regulations that establishes memory care standards. Another woman, Sarah Scoville Weaver, said she's had to sleep overnight at her mom's place to help out when caregivers don't know how to care for her. An owner of a facility has called her to ask her to come in to help the caregivers get her mom into the bathtub. When she's asked caregivers why they can't do it, they tell her they're not trained, Scoville Weaver said. What I want to know is why, if you truly wanted to improve conditions for your residents, you do not move mountains to pass these bills to improve training. The new regulations are set to take effect next month, though a state health official during the meeting noted they won't enforce everything right away. A spokesperson for the governor's office said Hobbs was glad to see the rules passed unanimously. When these rules and statutes take effect on July 1st, they will strengthen safety, foster trust, and reinforce accountability for those in the care of our aging community. The next article is entitled, Trump Tax Package Faces Speed Bumps, written by Riley Began. President Donald Trump is lobbying potential Senate holdouts in an effort to push through his sweeping tax plan, despite major concerns from multiple Republicans who fear the package's impact on the deficit and health care, and a blistering rebuke from former Department of Government Efficiency leader Elon Musk. The Republican president's second-term legislative agenda is on the line as the upper chamber is gearing up for a four-week sprint, during which they will seek to iron out concerns within the GOP conference and pass something that can also get through the House's narrow margins and onto the president's desk for signature into law. It won't be easy. As in the House, the Senate has fiscal conservatives who are concerned that the bill will add to the federal deficit, and moderates who have problems with the potential impact on Medicaid health coverage. Appeasing one camp will be hard without inflaming the frustrations of the other, forcing Republican leaders to strike a delicate balance to get the votes they need, as no Democrats are expected to support the proposal. Senate Majority Leader John Thune of South Dakota told reporters on June 3rd that Republicans will make some modifications to it, strengthen, and improve it. But at the end of the day, the math is very simple. It's 51 in the Senate and 218 in the House, Thune said, referencing the majority needed in both the House and Senate. So as we work through this process, we're going to have our eye on that prize. Several senators have said they are worried about the massive price tag of the legislation, which would extend Trump's 2017 tax cuts and implement several new ones, including major campaign promises such as no tax on tips or overtime. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has estimated that the bill would add more than $3 trillion to the federal debt over the next 10 years, adding to the country's already massive $36.2 trillion debt. The package also increases the debt ceiling by $4 trillion, another sticking point for some Republican senators. Senator Ron Johnson, Republican of Wisconsin, has drawn a red line over the boosted spending, saying he won't vote for the package unless it goes farther to cut spending and only raises the debt ceiling enough to avoid a default for a year. Senators Rick Scott, Republican of Florida, and Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, have similar concerns. Trump met with Scott and spoke on the phone with Johnson and Paul. Paul said the president didn't change his mind on the bill and that the two disagreed on his stance on the debt ceiling. Trump lashed out at him on social media the following day. Johnson said his conversation with Trump was cordial, but said he's still encouraging the White House to shift on his demands. While the fire of fiscal conservatives' concerns grow, Musk may have poured gasoline on it. Trump's billionaire former advisor, who led Doge, posted on X that the bill is outrageous and a disgusting abomination, followed shortly by a threat to primary Republicans who voted for the bill. Musk has been critical of the legislation, despite his support for the president pushing it. Musk's post came in the middle of the Republicans' lunch meeting. Johnson said it was passed around and that he texted it to a few people to underscore his point. Thune told reporters he and Musk have a difference of opinion. House Speaker Mike Johnson said the billionaire's comments were disappointing and said Musk is terribly wrong about the bill. Some Republicans, meanwhile, are worried that the cuts are too deep and could impact health care for low-income Americans. The House passed legislation would make major changes to Medicaid, saving $625 billion from the low-income health care program, while pushing an estimated 7.6 million Americans off of their coverage. Senators Josh Hawley, Republican of Missouri, and Jim Justice, Republican of West Virginia, are worried about a provision in the bill the House passed that limits states from raising money to pay for their part of Medicaid spending through health care-related taxes known as provider taxes. Hawley is also concerned about a portion of the bill he's calling the sick tax, which would require people who earn between 100% and 138% of the federal poverty level to pay up to $35 per medical service. That income range is currently a salary of $35,365 to $44,367 annually for a family of four. Trump and Hawley also spoke on the phone, during which Hawley said the president assured him there would be no Medicaid benefit cuts in the final package. Both the provider tax and the sick tax could be considered a benefit cut, Hawley said on June 2nd, because the former could close rural hospitals and the latter would make it more expensive for people to see a doctor. Senators will begin introducing their own version of the bill text, beginning with the least controversial portions of the bill this week and ending with the most divisive. That means the changes to Medicaid and task provisions, both overseen by the Senate Finance Committee, are likely to come later in the month. Whatever they craft will need to pass the Senate with at least 50 votes. If there is a 50-50 tie, Vice President J.D. Vance would be required to cast the tie-breaking vote. Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, Republican of Oklahoma, said he thinks their product can pass the House again as long as it doesn't go below the House's $1.5 trillion in spending cuts and doesn't touch a deal struck with blue state Republican House members who demanded changes to state and local tax deductions. The next article is titled, "Trump Orders Spur Privacy Concerns," written by Trevor Hughes. For decades, the government has been able to watch where you drive and where you walk. It can figure out where you shop, what you buy, and who you spend time with. It knows how much money you have, where you've worked, and in many cases, what medical procedures you've had. It can figure out if you've attended a protest or bought marijuana, and can even read your emails if it wants. But because all of those data points about you were scattered across dozens of federal, state, and commercial databases, it wasn't easy for the government to easily build a comprehensive file of your life. That's changing, fast. With the help of big tech, in just a few short months, the Trump administration has expanded the government's surveillance state to a whole new level as the president and his allies chase down illegal immigrants and suspected domestic terrorists while simultaneously trying to slash federal spending they have deemed wasteful and prevent foreigners from voting. And in doing so, privacy experts warn, the federal government is inevitably scooping up, sorting, combining, and storing data about millions of law-abiding Americans. The vast data storehouses, some of which have been targeted for access by Elon Musk's Doge teams, raise significant privacy concerns and the threat of cybersecurity breaches. What makes the Trump administration's approach so chilling is that they are seeking to collect and use data across federal agencies in ways that are unprecedented, said Cody Venske, a senior policy counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union. The federal government's collection of data has always been a double-edged sword. Americans have always fiercely guarded their privacy, even from the country's earliest days. The Constitution's Fourth Amendment specifically limits the government's ability to invade a person's privacy. Yet a 2023 survey by the Pew Research Center found that 71% of Americans worry about the government's use of data about them, up from 64% in 2019. The survey found the concern was greatest among those who lean or consistently vote Republican, up from 63% to 77%. The level of concern among those who lean or consistently vote Democrat remained steady at 65%, the survey found. That same survey found that Americans overall are almost as concerned about government access to their data as they are about social media companies having access. People who had attended college were more worried about data privacy, while people with high school degrees were, in general, confident that those who have access to their personal information will do the right thing. In acknowledgement of those concerns, the federal government carefully stores most data about Americans in separate databases, from Social Security payments to Medicare reimbursements, housing vouchers, and food stamps. That limits the ability of government workers to surreptitiously build comprehensive profiles of Americans without court oversight. But in the name of rooting out fraud and government inefficiency, President Donald Trump in March ordered federal agencies under his control to lower the walls between their data warehouses. The Government Accounting Office estimates the federal government loses $233 billion to $521 billion to fraud annually, much of that due to improper payments to contractors or falsified medical payments, according to an April GAO report. The report also noted significant losses via Medicare or unemployment fraud, and Pandemicera stimulus payments. Decades of restricted data access within and between agencies have led to duplicated efforts, undetected overpayments, and unchecked fraud costing taxpayers billions, Trump said in a March 20th executive order that helped create the new system. This executive order dismantles unnecessary barriers, promotes interagency collaboration, and ensures the federal government operates responsibly and efficiently to safeguard public funds. Supporters say this kind of data archive, especially video surveillance coupled with AI-powered facial recognition, can also be a powerful tool to fight crime. Authorities in New Orleans used video footage collected by privately owned security cameras to help capture at least one of the men who recently escaped jail. And systems that read license plates helped Colorado police track down a suspect accused of repeatedly vandalizing a Tesla dealership. But the new White House efforts go far beyond anything ever previously attempted in the United States, allowing the government to conduct intrusive surveillance against almost anyone by combining government and commercial databases. Privacy experts say it's the merging of government and commercial databases that poses the most significant concern because much of it can be done without court oversight. As part of the broader White House effort, contractors are currently building a $30 million system to track suspected gang members and undocumented immigrants, and buying access to a system that tracks passengers on virtually every U.S.-based airline flight. And federal officials are also making plans to compile and share state-level voting registration information, which the president argues is necessary to prevent foreign nationals from illegally voting in federal elections. Privacy experts say the Trump administration is dramatically expanding its compilation of all that data previously kept separate by different government agencies or private vendors, like your supermarket frequent shopper card and cell phone provider, into comprehensive dossiers on Americans. Much of the work has been kicked off by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency teams, with the assistance of billionaire Peter Thiel's Denver-based Palantir. Critics say such a system could track women who cross state lines for abortions, something a police officer in Texas is accused of doing, or be abused by law enforcement to target political critics or even stalk romantic partners. And if somehow accessed by hackers, the centralized system would prove a trove of information to commit fraud or blackmail. The nonpartisan nonprofit Project on Government Oversight has been warning about the risks of federal surveillance expansion for years, and noted that both Democrats and Republicans have voted to expand such information gathering. We need our leaders to recognize that as the surveillance apparatus grows, it becomes an enticing prize for a would-be autocrat, POGO said in an August 2024 report. Our country cannot build and expand a surveillance superstructure and expect that it will not be turned against the people it is meant to protect. The next article is entitled, Mesa's New Police Chief Will Be Butler, a 25-year veteran. Dan Butler, who has been with the Mesa Police Department for 25 years, will be the agency's next police chief. Butler will take the position on July 1st after Chief Ken Cost, who announced his retirement on April 10th after more than 30 years with the city, leaves the department. Butler was previously the department's executive assistant chief. I'm committed to continuing our focus on innovation, community engagement, and supporting our officers and professional staff. Together, we will maintain Mesa's position as one of America's safest cities, Butler said in a news release June 4th. Butler was at one point the head of the Patrol Operations Bureau, the department's largest operational unit encompassing Central, Fiesta, Red Mountain, and Superstition patrol divisions, as well as Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport operations. More recently, he oversaw department divisions including human resources, wellness, financial services, communications, and training. He has a Master of Administration degree from Northern Arizona University with a focus on leadership. The appointment of Butler comes just 2 days after Scott Butler was sworn in as the new city manager. The two men are not related, the city clarified in the release. Scott Butler, in his news release, said Dan Butler's experience and leadership made him the ideal choice to build upon Chief Cost's remarkable legacy. Dan has been instrumental in our department's recent achievements and possesses the vision and expertise to guide us through our next phase of growth and innovation. Cost became the police chief during the tumultuous time for the department, amid investigations into excessive use of force and the sudden departure of Chief Ramon Batista. Dan Butler's appointment shows the city's desire to keep the status quo by promoting from within rather than doing a nationwide search. Chief Butler's appointment reflects our commitment to promoting excellence from within our ranks, said Mesa Mayor Mark Freeman. Freeman said in a news release that he was confident Dan Butler would continue Mesa's reputation as a leader in modern policing. You're listening to Hour One of today's Arizona Republic on Sunsounds of Arizona. I'm Jack Palmer, and we'll continue with an article titled, "Injured Apache Junction Officer is a Fighter," Chief says. Apache Junction police have identified the officer critically wounded June 2nd by a driver with a ghost gun as Officer Gabriel Facio, 3-year veteran of the agency. Police Chief Michael Pooley said on June 3rd that Facio remained in critical condition a day after he was shot in what escalated from a road rage incident. Facio, a married father of two, was kind of the heartbeat of our department, Pooley said. He called Facio a fighter, but asked for support from the Apache Junction community. It is heartbreaking to see one of your strong, tough officers in a very dire situation, Pooley said. So again, we ask for prayers and comfort for the family, support from the community. The incident began just after 9 a.m. June 2nd, when officers responded to the area of Ironwood Drive and Elliott Road on reports of a driver brandishing a gun, the chief said. An officer found the vehicle matching the description, a white Tesla, and stopped it, Pooley said. The driver was compliant and showed no signs of aggression whatsoever, the chief said. When the officer asked the driver to step out of the vehicle, he pulled the handgun from the glove box, got out, and began walking away, Pooley said. Officers followed the man as he walked south on Ironwood Drive with a firearm for about a mile, Pooley said. He did say at some point that he wanted the officer to shoot him. Officers tried to get the man to stop and used a pepper ball gun, but it had no effect on him whatsoever, the chief said. Near Radiance Avenue, the man made a quick move and fired 4 rounds, hitting Facio in the face, Pooley said. 4 other officers returned fire, and one then took Facio in a patrol vehicle to the hospital for treatment, Pooley said. They were placed on paid administrative leave as part of the routine response to an officer-involved shooting. Apache Junction police identified the driver of the white Tesla as Roger Nunez, 37 years old, of Apache Junction. The handgun he used was a ghost gun, Pooley said. He did not provide specifics about the weapon. Generally, ghost guns are those that do not have a traceable serial number. They are sometimes 3D printed. Pooley said Mesa police were investigating the incident and would recommend Nunez be charged with multiple counts of aggravated assault. The chief said the officers who responded saved Facio's life. Had those officers not reacted the way they did, Officer Facio would have lost his life yesterday on that street, the chief said. There's no doubt in my mind. Pooley said Facio was known for supporting his fellow law enforcement officers and had a great attitude. Facio previously worked briefly in Phoenix. He's just a wonderful human being and one of my personal favorites. I'm not supposed to have favorites, but I'll tell you he is one of my favorites, the chief said. He really is just the heartbeat of this department, and it's a very, very difficult time for our officers right now. The next article is titled, Trump Administration Drops Biden Guidance on Emergency Abortions. The Trump administration has rescinded a Biden administration policy informing hospitals and doctors that they can provide emergency abortions to stabilize pregnant women, even in states restricting abortions. The Trump administration said earlier this week that former President Joe Biden's guidance and communications on emergency abortions do not reflect the policy of this administration. The Biden administration issued the guidance in 2022 after the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Mississippi's Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, which prompted more than a dozen states to enact abortion bans or restrictions. In 2022, Xavier Becerra, Biden's health secretary, issued a letter informing hospitals and doctors that a federal law protects your clinical judgment and the action that you take to provide stabilizing medical treatment to your pregnant patients, even in states that restricted abortion access. The federal law, called the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, or EMTALA, requires hospitals that take Medicare or Medicaid payments to diagnose and stabilize anyone seeking emergency medical care. Becerra's letter spelled out that such emergency care could include abortion, removal of fallopian tubes, or treatments for high blood pressure, even in states that banned abortion or scaled back access. After issuing the guidance, the U.S. Department of Justice sued Idaho in a bid to stop it from enforcing its near-total abortion ban in medical emergencies. A federal judge at the Justice Department's urging blocked Idaho from enforcing the ban during medical emergencies, but the Trump administration in March dropped that lawsuit, resulting in that injunction being lifted. The ban remains blocked in emergencies due to another suit filed by a hospital system, Reuters reported. The Trump administration said June 3rd it has rescinded Becerra's letter and Biden's policy guidance on emergency abortions, moves that advocates said could strip away protections for women who need emergency medical care. The Trump administration's decision to withdraw EMTALA guidance guaranteeing pregnant people medical care in emergency situations will sow confusion for providers and endanger the lives and health of pregnant people, said Sky Perryman, president and CEO of Democracy Forward. Every American deserves the right to access the necessary care in emergency situations, including pregnant people, without political interference. The Trump administration will continue to enforce EMTALA, including for identified emergency medical conditions that place the health of a pregnant woman or her unborn child in serious jeopardy, according to a statement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, as well as Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. The agency overseeing Medicare will rectify any perceived legal confusion and instability created by the former administration's actions, the statement said. The Trump administration's announcement on emergency medical abortions comes as the abortion drug mifepristone may also come under renewed scrutiny. Federal Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Martin McCary said he was committed to conducting a review. In a letter sent Senator Josh Hawley, Republican of Missouri, which he posted on X on June 2nd. If you miss any of these articles, you can always listen on demand by going to our website, sunsounds.org, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then On Demand. We'll continue with an article titled, Musk Calls Trump's Tax Bill an Abomination. Days after leaving his role in the White House as senior advisor and leading the Department of Government Efficiency, Elon Musk excoriated President Donald Trump's tax and domestic policy bill as a disgusting abomination, escalating his criticism of the president's signature legislation. Musk's pointed June 3rd remarks came after Trump held a friendly send-off for Musk in the Oval Office on May 30th, and as Trump is working to push what he's called his big, beautiful bill through the Senate after the legislation cleared the House along party lines in May. "I'm sorry, I just can't stand it anymore," Musk said in a post on his social media platform X. This massive, outrageous, pork-filled congressional spending bill is a disgusting abomination. Shame on those who voted for it. You know you did wrong. You know it. The bill would extend Trump's 2017 tax cuts, implement new tax breaks for tipped wages and overtime, overhaul Medicaid and food stamps, and put more money toward Trump's immigrant deportation plan. Republican leaders are trying to pass the Senate bill through a filibuster budget process known as reconciliation. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimated the bill would add $3.8 trillion to the national debt over the next 10 years. It will massively increase the already gigantic budget deficit of $2.5 trillion and burden American citizens with crushingly unsustainable debt, Musk said in a follow-up post. Musk, CEO of Tesla and SpaceX, left the White House as the White House senior advisor last week after leading the Department of Government Efficiency for the past 4 months. Before signing off, Musk said in an interview with CBS Sunday Morning that he was disappointed with Trump's reconciliation bill, arguing it will grow the deficit and undermines the work DOGE has been doing. Yet Musk and Trump had seemed to smooth things over when the president welcomed the billionaire tech entrepreneur to the Oval Office for one final news conference with reporters. "We'll remember you as we announce billions of dollars of extra waste, fraud, and abuse," Trump told Musk, lauding him as one of the greatest business leaders and innovators the world has ever produced. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt shrugged off Musk's latest criticism of the tax and policy bill. "Look, the president already knows where Elon Musk stood on this bill," Leavitt said. "It doesn't change the president's opinion. This is one big, beautiful bill, and he's sticking to it." But Musk's objections to the long-term financial costs associated with Trump's bill mirror concerns held by some Republican senators, including Rand Paul of Kentucky and Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, whose votes are crucial for Trump to pass the legislation with only Republican support. "I agree with Elon," Paul said in a post on X. "We have both seen the massive waste in government spending, and we know another $5 trillion in debt is a huge mistake. We can and we must do better." The next article is entitled, Trump says Putin plans to respond to Ukraine attack. President Donald Trump said Russian President Vladimir Putin told him during a June 4th call that he plans to retaliate against Ukraine's recent surprise drone attack that destroyed dozens of Russian bombers. In a post on Truth Social, Trump described the more than an hour-long phone call as a good conversation, but added that it was not a conversation that will lead to immediate peace. "We discussed the attack on Russia's docked airplanes by Ukraine," Trump said, referring to Ukraine's surprise drone attack that destroyed dozens of Russian bombers, and also various other attacks that have been taking place by both sides. President Putin did say, and very strongly, that he will have to respond to the recent attack on the airfields, Trump said. Kremlin foreign policy aide Yuri Ushakov confirmed the call between Putin and Trump to Reuters, saying it focused on recent attacks and the second round of Russia-Ukraine negotiations. The call was the first time Trump has spoken to Putin since he warned the Russian president last week that he's playing with fire by attacking Ukraine during peace talks. Trump, however, has resisted imposing sanctions on Russia. And since returning to the White House, Trump has placed equal blame on Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky for Russia's war. Ukrainian intelligence said the coordinated drone strikes carried out June 1st took a $7 billion toll on Russia's military and demolished more than a third of Moscow's strategic cruise missile carriers, including planes capable of carrying nuclear warheads. The stunning attack came after Russian forces launched a deadly barrage of hundreds of drones and missiles at Ukrainian cities on May 25th, prompting Trump to say Putin had gone absolutely crazy. Later, Trump warned that Putin is playing with fire by refusing to engage in ceasefire talks. Trump, who has struggled to mediate meaningful peace negotiations between Putin and Zelensky, has recently taken more of a back seat. After Trump had a two-hour call with Putin on May 15th, Trump said conditions for the next round of peace talks would be negotiated between the two parties. Recounting his June 4th call with Putin, Trump also said they discussed Iran, which had just dismissed a proposal from the Trump administration for a deal that would prevent it from developing potential nuclear weapons technology. Ushakov said Trump expressed the view that Russia's cooperation was essential in addressing the issue. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, rejected a central U.S. demand that Iran abandon nuclear enrichment, calling it 100% against the country's interests. "I stated to President Putin that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon, and on this, I believe that we were in agreement," Trump said, adding that Putin suggested during the call that he participate in the discussions with Iran. "It is my opinion that Iran has been slow-walking their decision on this very important matter, and we will need a definitive answer in a very short period of time," Trump said. The next article is entitled, "Gaza Aid Group Pauses Distribution," written by Nidal Almograbi, Crispian Balmer, and Michelle Nichols. The U.S.-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation did not give out any aid on June 4th as it pressed Israel to boost civilian safety beyond the perimeter of its distribution sites after dozens of Palestinians seeking aid were killed last week. The GHF said it has asked the Israeli military to guide foot traffic in a way that minimizes confusion or escalation risks near military positions, develop clearer guidance for civilians, and enforce training to support civilian safety. Hospital officials have said more than 80 people were shot dead and hundreds wounded near distribution points in a three-day period from June 1st, including at least 27 killed on June 3rd. Locals say Israeli soldiers opened fire on the crowds who gather before dawn to seek food. The military has denied this, but acknowledged on June 3rd that soldiers had fired at suspects who had ignored warning shots and were approaching their lines. Our top priority remains ensuring the safety and dignity of civilians receiving aid, said a GHF spokesperson. An Israeli military spokesperson warned civilians against moving in areas leading to GHF sites on June 4th, deeming them combat zones. The new aid distribution process for Gaza's 2 million-plus population from just three sites was launched in the midst of a fierce new offensive by Israel. The United Nations and other aid groups say the model, which uses private U.S. security and logistic workers, militarizes aid. Violence continued to pommel the enclave. The Gaza Health Ministry said Israeli strikes had killed at least 95 Palestinians in the past 24 hours, including people at a school housing displaced families that was hit near the southern city of Khan Yunis. Israel announced that one of its soldiers had died in the fighting after three deaths reported a day earlier as its forces continued their months-long battle to eliminate Hamas militants and free the remaining hostages still held in Gaza. The UN Security Council was set to vote on June 4th on a demand for a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas and humanitarian access across Gaza, where malnutrition is widespread and aid has only trickled in since Israel lifted an 11-week blockade in late May. It is unacceptable. Civilians are risking and in several instances losing their lives just trying to get food, UN spokesperson Stefan Dujarric said on June 3rd, adding that the aid distribution model backed by the United States and Israel was all a recipe for disaster, which is exactly what is going on. The GHF said on June 3rd that it has given out more than 7 million meals since it started operations a week ago. GHF Interim Executive Director John Acree urged humanitarians in Gaza, work with us and we will get your aid delivered to those who are depending on it. Experts say Gaza's entire population is at risk of famine despite successive efforts to boost aid. Jordan last year spearheaded humanitarian airdrops while the United States briefly installed a floating aid pier, though it was beset by challenges. The UN has long blamed Israel and lawlessness in the enclave for hindering the delivery of aid into Gaza and its distribution throughout the war zone. Israel accuses Hamas of stealing aid, which the group denies. The 10 elected members of the UN Security Council have asked for the 15-member body to vote on June 4th on a draft resolution that demands an immediate, unconditional, and permanent ceasefire in Gaza, respected by all parties. The draft text seen by Reuters also demands the release of all hostages held by Hamas and others and the immediate lifting of all restrictions on the entry of aid and its safe and unhindered distribution, including by the UN, throughout Gaza. The time to act has already passed, Slovenia's UN Ambassador Samuel Zgbogar told Reuters. It is our historical responsibility not to remain silent. As President Donald Trump's administration tries to broker a ceasefire in Gaza, it was not immediately clear if Washington would veto the draft text, as it traditionally has done with resolutions not to Israel's liking. Israel has rejected calls for an unconditional or permanent ceasefire, saying Hamas cannot be allowed to remain in Gaza. A spokesperson for the U.S. mission to the UN said, "We cannot preview our actions currently under consideration." A resolution needs 9 votes in favor and no vetoes by the permanent members, the United States, Russia, China, Britain, or France, to pass. The war in Gaza has raged since Hamas militants killed 1,200 people in Israel in an October 7, 2023 attack and took some 250 hostages back to the enclave, according to Israeli tallies. Most of those killed or captured were civilians. Israel responded with a military campaign that has killed more than 54,000 Palestinians, according to Gaza health authorities. They do not distinguish between fighters and non-combatants, but say civilians have borne the brunt of the attacks, and the thousands more bodies have been lost under the rubble. The next article is titled, U.S. Judge Says Deportees Can Contest Detention, written by Luke Cohen. Hundreds of Venezuelans deported from the United States to El Salvador under an 18th century wartime law must be given the chance to challenge their detentions, and the Trump administration must facilitate the legal challenges, a U.S. judge ruled on June 4th. U.S. District Judge James Boasberg stopped short of expressly ordering the Trump administration to bring the hundreds of Venezuelan migrants currently being held in a mega prison in El Salvador back to the United States. The judge gave the Trump administration 1 week to detail how it would facilitate the deportees' filings of legal challenges. In his ruling, Boasberg wrote that the individuals were deported without adequate notice or the right to contest their removals. That process, which was improperly withheld, must now be afforded to them, Boasberg wrote. Absent this relief, the government could snatch anyone off the street, turn him over to a foreign country, and then effectively foreclose any corrective course of action. It was not immediately clear how the migrants would file the legal challenges, known as habeas corpus petitions, from within El Salvador's terrorism confinement center. And that's all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Jack Palmer. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.